We're going to have a chance to chat now with four very important names from the good old days of radio, if you will. Lorenzo Jones and Lord Henry Brinthrop and Laura Lawton and Nora Drake. And all four of those people are rolled up into two very talented people. We have Joan Tompkins and Carl Swenson. Welcome to our good old radio reveille here.
Thank you. It feels so good to be with radio people.
And you're speaking of days that were a lot of fun, but it happens that you have more than four here, because Joan was on Ma Perkins.
Ah.
And I was the strange romance of Evelyn Winters. I played the title role.
You were the strange romance.
Yes, that's right. And at that time would do daytime shows and the nighttime shows, so that Cavalcade of America and March of Time and
Can I interrupt?
Yes.
I wanted to tell about one of the few times that I've been very much of a fan, and this was before we were legally wed and all that kind of thing, so it had nothing to do with anything except my admiration for him as an artist. I was home with a cold or something one time, and because what did you do in those days except listen to the radio? So I was listening to the radio, and I heard Carl. He did Lord Henry Brinthrop, and he did Lorenzo Jones, and he did The Strange Romance of Evelyn Winters, and then that night he played Abraham Lincoln. And I couldn't find Carl in any of them, and I thought that was pretty spectacular, you know, so I think I left out Mr. Chameleon. I think you did a Mr. Chameleon that day, too.
Yeah.
And so I wrote him a fan letter. I've never been quite sure whether he married me because of that fan letter. Or anyway, I really meant it.
How long have you been married?
Do we have to tell?
I think we should.
23 years.
Yeah.
And they say these Hollywood weddings never last, right?
Well, we can't. We have to.
You were married in New York State.
Yes,
that
makes sense.
Oh, you're an import. Huh?
Yes.
Are you both from the New York area?
Yes.
He was born on the wrong side of the tracks in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, USA.
And I was born in Manhattan. Yes.
Oh, you were born in Brooklyn, but
I was not. I was born in Manhattan under a bridge.
Oh, I thought you were on the other side of the
Brooklyn
Bridge.
Yeah, there was a hospital there at the time.
Oh, and then your family lived in Brooklyn
for
6 months before they moved up to Westchester.
To prepare her for real life.
Exactly.
Yes. And, well, an interesting, the long arm of coincidence. She lived in Westchester for much of her life, and then we were married in Westchester, because I still had my house there, and the house had 17 rooms, and it was after a divorce, and before the divorce I had four children and a wife living there, so we and three dogs, so the 17 rooms were fine, but to rent that amount of space for a wedding would have been awfully expensive. And since I already had it, we were married in Westchester County, Joan's home county.
Maybe it wasn't the fan letter that made you marry me. Maybe you just wanted to fill up that house as fast as possible.
Well, Joan had two dogs,
yes.
So that helped to fill up the house.
So that you had just the two dogs.
Yes,
you lost
we no
children.
No children, but we were sort of entitled to part-time children. The kids came and were with us a great deal at the time. So I felt that I had four good stepsons.
Joan, when you were writing that fan letter to Carl, were you on radio yourself?
Yes, I was. And I still can't remember whether I was on vacation or homesick. I very seldom got sick, and usually if you were sick in radio, you did the show anyway.
You
so I
it
probably
no what.
I think it was more likely that I was on vacation and happened to be listening, and I was really pretty fascinated. That sort of versatility was only in radio. You don't find that anywhere, that people in one day so completely alter their whole approach to their craft that they can do that many characters. Of course, not many people can either. I must say, I think Carl's talent was very unique as far as versatility was concerned.
Now you really know why she's not married.
She's really a fan. Well, I agree with you. His talent is
unique.
Now, I want to talk about your career, Carl, for a couple of moments, and then we'll segue to Joan's career and then see how they work together and in and out and around and all of that.
Uh-huh.
When did you first get involved in radio?
I was playing in the theater in one Sunday afternoon. which was the only hit I ever was in on Broadway. And somebody said, my golly, why don't you, you have the afternoons off, you just play at night except matinee days, why don't you find out about radio? So I began going around, and that would have been in the 30s, 34, 35, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. And within about a year, I got a show which was called Rich Man's Darling.
But you played the title role in that, too?
No, I didn't play the title role. However, we had some interesting lines in it, and one of them was where I had to break the news to a lady that her husband had been in a motorboat accident. And I was a newspaper reporter, and I said, but you mustn't worry, he's not badly hurt, he just burned around the edges.
That's awful.
And that was followed by, or replaced by, it went off the air after the man was burned around the edges, and it was replaced by Our Gal Sunday. And Our Gal Sunday had a cast that was engaged for it. They played for 2 weeks, and then they switched and replaced all of the main characters. And so that I then became Lord Henry Brinthrop, England's richest and handsomest lord. And
wow.
That lasted a long time.
How did they do that? You mean you were in a secondary role?
No.
Initially?
No. I lost the job that I had because we went off the air with Rich Man's Darling.
Yeah.
And then I was called in to audition for Our Gal Sunday after it went on the air.
See, they were pretty whimsical in those days. And I think that in the same way that people are very eager for immediate successes in television, and if they don't have it right away, then they get panicky and they shift things around.
First thing you do is fire the actor.
or the writer, or sometimes both. But that's really what was happening in those days in radio, too. If there wasn't an immediate reaction on the various ratings and from the various newspapers and things like that, then you quickly shifted gears. And I think that's what happened with
I think so, too.
With Our Gal. And it worked because, I don't know how many years that was on, but awful lot.
That was, wasn't that a Hummert production?
Yes,
it was. Mm-hmm. And the Hummerts ran, were responsible for so many shows that they were very strict executives. They would make decisions like that, and that explains the lightning-like change in the Our Gal Sunday setup.
And Sunday was Vivian Smolin.
Mm-hmm. Well, first it was
Dorothy Lowell.
Dorothy Lowell, whom I played with, and Dorothy died, and Vivian Smolin took it over. And Vivian played it until the very end. I left the show and came out here, but Vivian played until the very last broadcast, which was on a Friday, and on Sunday she was married.
Well, Sunday was an appropriate
yes,
day.
Yes, sure. She went from one career to another.
And one Sunday to another Sunday.
Well, then you were Lord Henry Brinthrop, rich and handsome?
England's richest and handsomest yeah. lord.
Carl always yeah. says it as if it's one word. Lord Henry Brinthrop, England's richest and handsomest. I can't say it.
Oh, well, that was one of the most... I can't say most colorful descriptions on radio. I mean, they gave that the title and they said who you were every day and every day.
Oh, yes, and they had a rather long lead-in. The Our Gal Sunday, the story that asks the question, can a young girl, an orphan, found on the steps of two old miners in Silver Creek, Colorado, find happiness married to Lord Henry Brinthrop, England's richest and handsomest lord.
Did the story take place in New York?
Black Swan Hall.
Black Swan Hall, of course.
Yes, in right. Virginia. We had a Virginia. Huge mansion there. And it must have been very large because we had guests who would come and they would be a part of the show for a long time. And then that plot would play out. However, they rarely said goodbye. And so the new plot would start, and you assumed that they were somewhere in Black Swan Hall, still wandering around.
Walking from bathroom to bathroom? Yeah. That show lasted till almost, I guess it was into 1960, 59 or 60, I guess.
Yes, it was one of the last ones to go. CBS did an interesting thing. They wanted to bail themselves out of the amount of money that they had spent, both CBS and NBC, experimenting with TV. And TV wasn't quite ready yet, but they were hurting for money. So they began to commercialize TV. They sold time when it still was not there. However, radio was still earning money hand over fist for them. And there was some discontent with the way it was working out for radio, and CBS bought up almost all of the shows they had playing on radio at that time, daytime shows, and they developed system that was called the participation system. And in that way, Sterling Drugs or American Home would not own Argyle Sunday, but a whole group of people, of advertisers, would be allowed to advertise during the day. They would have so many spots during the day. And CBS, controlling all of the shows, was able to give them a slot.
This was probably the very beginning of the spot announcement on radio today, as we know it.
It may well be.
Because almost through the 40s, programs were totally and wholly sponsored by an individual company. And right. They may have owned two or three or four soap operas, Procter & Gamble, for example, sponsoring four different in a row, maybe each with a different one of their Procter & Gamble products.
Yeah, Occidental's own Ma Perkins. And B-A-B-O, that was David Harum, I remember.
Rinso White.
Rinso White.
The bird singing.
Yes. The Hummerts had a long and illustrious career in radio. Mr. Hummert developed the first serial show, radio show, for
I wish I could help you.
Procter and Gamble.
Was it?
In Chicago. And that was before the Procter and Gamble had Ma Perkins. And then it went on from there, and as a part of quite a large company that organized around him and then amalgamated with another company, moved to New York. And they had at one time, I think they had 20 shows going.
Oh, more than that. 27 sticks in my mind for some reason, but it was an extraordinary achievement.
Well, they were extremely prolific, Frank and Ann Hummert.
Yes.
Names that, and all the writers who worked for them were incognito. You never heard their names, you know.
Very often that was so.
They didn't give them credit, but everything was said it was written by Frank and Ann Hummert.
We had dinner last night with two of the incognitos, Ted and Matt Farrow, who used to write Lorenzo Jones.
When did Lorenzo Jones come in on the scene? And were you the first Lorenzo?
I was the first Lorenzo Jones, and it opened, it started the same week as Argyle Sunday. A very odd coincidence, just a few days apart.
And at the same time that you were doing both English most blah blah blah.
Oh, yes.
yes.
Winthrop and Lorenzo Jones.
Yes.
Two quite different characters, as you pointed
out.
That's
the extraordinary thing.
Well, that was a big help, too, because when you played year after year and day after day the same character, and the situations, of course, were different, it did get to be pretty draggy. And the contrast of Lorenzo and Lord Henry, I think, helped me a great deal and prevented my going mad with boredom.
You were probably in almost every Lorenzo Jones episode,
yes.
I would imagine that.
Yeah.
But not necessarily in every Argyle Sunday episode. Probably.
I was in almost every Argyle Sunday episode. They, with radio, they could go to a wild set, and because they didn't have to build it, mm-hmm. and relate to a character who was not at home. For instance, Henry used to go on business trips, but they usually kept in touch with him. He was on a train
thinking. He did a great deal of thinking. Yes.
Nearing Memphis or or something. There was a thing I wanted to say about the Lincoln. I played Lincoln on radio several times, mm-hmm. but it was extremely fascinating to work with it. And this would be absolutely impossible for me to play Lincoln on the stage or in film. But with it gave us a latitude that was very wonderful in radio. Radio was a great place for the actor because he did have the opportunity for so much variety.
You, of course, depended upon the listener to add the essential ingredient of imagination.
And I think that's the essential ingredient of why radio was such a great medium, because the audience did participate. And in almost any medium, like the silent pictures, for instance, you supplied the words. Mm-hmm. And it made you a participant. So because you created part of it, you liked it better. And it fit your imagination, what you had thought.
I think also it's very important. I think your mind gets terribly lazy if you're not encouraged to imagine. I think it gets like a piece of rubber that's been stretched too much and kind of loses its excitement.
Joan, what was your first radio job?
Oh, I played an ingenue on a one-shot show in which the heroine was Agnes Moorehead, God rest her soul, and she was, to me, the most beautiful, most glamorous, most exciting woman I had ever seen in my life. She had eyelashes an inch long and gorgeous red hair and a voice to go with that. And I barely came in to say my few lines because I was so busy adoring this glamorous creature. And then after that, I began almost immediately auditioning for almost all of the daytime shows. I'm not quite sure why that happened. It seemed to happen without my doing much about it. And very fortunately, many of the auditions I won. So quite quickly, I started to work as a radio ingenue.
You were supporting all the time, all this time, though. I mean, in supporting roles.
Well, as the lead ingenue in, I think the first series that I got, I played Lucille Wall's daughter. And Lucille Wall was at that time playing Carl's wife on Lorenzo Jones. But this we didn't know that there was ever going to be a relationship of any kind. And I came in to audition for the ingenue on a thing called Your Family and Mine. And I played on that for the two.
You were Judy Wilbur, the red-headed angel, weren't you?
I certainly was. My goodness, I certainly was. I just loved being a red-headed angel. I thought that was very romantic. And there were a lot of very famous people on that show. Frank Lovejoy was the lead, the romantic lead, and that we became very good friends then. It was that was a nice relationship. Bill Adams, who was a big radio star in those days, played my father. And there were so many people on that show that were high-quality actors. I was proud of being on it.
Bill Adams eventually was Uncle Bill Adams on the Let's Pretend series, I'm sure.
He probably was. I didn't know much about Let's Pretend. Let's Pretend in those days had all the children on it, and I was a few years beyond that. Lucille Wall wouldn't let me sign my contract, I remember, on Your Family and Mine, because she said, your mother's going to have to be here to sign that with you. And I said, I am 19 years old, and I can sign my own contract.
There is an interesting point of difference. Joni spoke of the fact that she began to be called for all the ingenue auditions. Mm-hmm. In radio, you did not have an agent. And the people who were casting directors for a network or for a producing outfit like the Hummerts, they kept very much in touch with everything that was going on, so that they did not wait for the recommendation of an agent, as we do here in casting of pictures. Mm-hmm. They will, unless you have made a big hit in a current picture, they will usually not call you unless an agent recommends you. And there are pros and cons for both of these things, of course. Sometimes we feel very frustrated when young people come and say, well, what do I do? Well, you say you can't do a damn thing, a darn thing, excuse me, sir, blip me. can't do a thing until you have an agent. And
getting an agent now is very, very difficult. Because
the agents are shortening their lists, and there are many young people who do not have agents and who won't be getting work for some years. And experience is terribly important, and that was, as I said before, one of the wonderful things about radio. Fred Allen, in an interview once, said that it was difficult for the comedians coming up because there was no vaudeville anymore, and he said there's just no place to be lousy.
That's right.
That's right. That's true. And so much today in television, so much depends on the first couple of shows that they have to get the pros in all the time, and there is no training ground, not
That's
for television.
Right.
They have the various schools, and I don't know very much about them. I don't know how much good they do. I know that when I first came out here, the only reason I eventually got any work at all was because I was a new face. And that is an absolutely insatiable monster television. They just gobble up people and qualities and writers and stories. It can never, you never satisfy its appetite. So that new faces are important. There will be very often be a kind of an excitement over a new face, which may or may not last. You know, just the newness is a little help at first, but the agent is now indispensable and terribly difficult to get.
Joan, you were both Laura Lawton and Nora Drake. These were the leads in the two long-running radio series.
And I was Faye, and that always hurt me a little bit. There's a radio book that came out that had the had all the casts of the different, and of course I looked myself up immediately, and found out that they had left me out of the Ma Perkins cast, which hurt me a lot because I really loved doing that show. I loved Ginny Payne. I loved all the people that were on it. And I enjoyed, when they moved to New York, the girl who had been playing Faye, the daughter of Ma, one of the daughters, in Chicago, came with the show, and after a very short time decided that she didn't, her husband and interests were in Chicago, and she went back to Chicago. So I took over the part, and I played it for the rest of the run of Ma Perkins until I came out here, which was maybe 6 months or so before it finished. And I wasn't given any credit in that book, and I was really quite hurt.
Well, we have, a lot of our listeners have copies of that book.
Well, they do?
Right.
See that they write my name in it.
So we want everyone to add to the Ma Perkins list now. It's Joan Tompkins, T-O-M-P-K-I-N-S.
Good man.
Right under Rita Ascott.
That's fine.
That's
that would be lovely. I'd appreciate it very much because it was such a lovely show to do. And I remember it with great affection. And I was I also did various little running part, young girl parts that ran for a while in almost all the Air Features shows. I guess I worked all of them one time.
Air Features, was that?
That was the Hummer.
Yes,
that's right.
Stable.
And it was nice. You really had so many families. I know that sounds corny, but as I look back on radio, it's the thing I think I remember the most about it, that when you worked together as often as you did, even though it was usually an hour and a quarter at a time, an hour's rehearsal and 15 minutes broadcast, it was every day. And you all knew each other's problems and happinesses and excitements, and it was a very intimate kind of a way, but you had it not just with one group, but with many groups, so that really we were very rich.
You had you were probably doing, as Carl was, a number of different shows at one time.
Yes.
So you do an hour rehearsal and a 15-minute broadcast. Mm-hmm.
And then you run over to another studio.
CBS again, or yes. NBC, yeah. Or someplace for another show. Did you ever find yourself in competition with your close friends for certain roles?
Always were, and that's another lovely thing that happened, I think, and it still works out here. When we go on usually commercial auditions is where you sit in a room with all of your age group and all of the people with the same kind of background you have, and you're all competing for one part. And there is perhaps because of our background, there is no or very, very slight jealousy or envy or any of the nasty things. Instead, it's another time to get together and talk and see each other and find out what's happening, and everybody's always happy for whoever gets the job.
And we are hungry for company of contemporaries and people that we have worked with, as Joan suggested. We became very close to one another because of the fact that we did so many shows together, and sometimes you'd be together every day of the week for a period of months. And then there were a limited number of places to go for lunch, and NBC and CBS were fairly close together. So that there was a social life that, as well as that family life, so that you had your family life at home as well as this life of remarkable closeness in those radio days. And today, as Joan says, with the auditions, you see them, and then when you do a radio show, there are very few done, and you go and make a tape. Everybody, at one point or another, says, "Gee, it's nice to be doing radio again," and because there was a teamwork. The fact that we had to do things with so little rehearsal, it meant that we very quickly understood how the other person worked, and we could complement one another very well. And I think it's one of the best things about radio acting, that the team worked very, very beautifully together.
Once you had established a character such as Lorenzo Jones, and your Lucille Wall was Belle,
yeah,
and you had one or two other regulars in there, I'm sure it was really a piece of cake to walk in and get the script cold, no doubt,
yeah,
and go right through it.
Well, that was, for many years, a really marvelous script. It was, mm-hmm, along with Ethel and Albert what was the gorgeous one from
one
Chicago?
In Chicago. Bernardine.
Vic and Sade.
I think those three shows were really the rare ones, because they were good comedy.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful writing.
Really well-written and beautifully characterized, and they, until, I don't know, toward the end of the radio, radio's life, they decided for some reason to make Lorenzo Jones a serious, I put that in quotes, soap opera, mm-hmm, type of thing, where Lorenzo lost his memory and Belle went through all kinds of agonies, and it changed the quality completely, and it became just another one. But up until that time, it had been really one of the rare ones.
Lorenzo was a character to the town, but not to his wife, Belle,
who loved him. That's right.
Do you know where Lucille Wall is now?
No.
She's Nurse Lucille on General Hospital on TV daily, 5 days a week. And she is on almost every five days. And so, of course, she has to live here in Hollywood.
I think that's another nice story that we might tell a little bit of. I think that Lucille wouldn't mind. It's a beautiful story. At the beginning, when Lucille first came out here, she was, as we all did, looking desperately for work out here. It was a whole new life. And Matt and Teddy Farrow, the writers of Lorenzo, were here, and they had begun writing this new series called General Hospital. Mm-hmm. They were writing as one of the teams on it. And Nurse A or something like that, had to say yes doctor, no doctor, or something like that. And they suggested Lucille for the job, and they accepted her, and she went in there and did that, and it was her sort of getting her feet wet. And then several weeks later, there was another Nurse B or something, and they said, why don't we get the same nurse? So she came back and did it again, yes doctor, no doctor, and right away doctor. And each time there was a nurse in the corridor or something, Lucille was called for it, because they were used to her and they knew her. And all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, over a period of time, it grew into a marvelous part. Working consistently, she became the bottom of the pyramid in General Hospital, I think, and really has been, well, I don't know how many years that is, but 12 or 15 anyway,
yes.
And she has been working on it all that time.
A lot of the radio people who've come out here have ended up in many of the soap operas on television, and of course in many other areas of television.
Many of them are still in New York on the soap
too,
operas.
Yeah. Did you, have either one of you worked in the television with, in the soaps?
Yes, that's a hard job. Really hard job, yes. Carl started in television in New York doing The Inner Flame.
Yeah, I played the title role again.
That's a hot one.
The Inner Flame was originally Portia Faces Life, and they translated it from radio over to TV as Portia Faces Life for several months. Mm-hmm. And then they changed the title to The Inner Flame.
Mm-hmm. And that was that was really his getting his feet wet in New York in live television.
And that was hard to do.
You did Edge of Night for a little while there, too.
Yes. And on Edge of Night, we had the teleprompter. And I was very much afraid of that. But the man who played the central character, it was a half-hour show, was on every day. That was Johnny Larkin.
You just can't do that kind of memorizing. Your mind gets soggy after a while. You can't keep learning it.
So that I made up my mind that I was not going to use that thing. One day on the air, I was playing a scene, and I was playing away from Johnny and thinking, talking, and became aware that the words that I was saying were right in front of my eyes. And I had unconsciously rested my eyes on the teleprompter. And then panic set in because I was afraid to take my eyes off because I wouldn't be able to remember what came next. So I had to finish the speech watching the teleprompter and then turn away.
Did you ever have a problem with any of the radio shows like that, where you lost a script or was missing?
Tell about Lucille. Can you tell about that job? That's one of the funny stories of radio.
Lucille did Portia Faces Life from 4 to 4:15 in Studio 8B, and in 8C we did Lorenzo from 4:15 to 4:30. And so she had already rehearsed Lorenzo and then went over and rehearsed Portia and went on the air with it and then came back and played Lorenzo and whipped around the corner and picked up her script and during the commercial and the lead-in. And John Brown, a very wonderful comedian and great actor who came out here and has since died, he was also on Alan's Alley.
Don't get off the subject now.
The three of us were playing a scene, and there was a silence, and Lucille pointed to me across the microphone, and I shook my head no, and she insisted and kept pointing, and I shook my head because it was her speech. And then she came over to my side of the microphone and put her finger on the script, on the line that should be said, which was hers, and I had no choice but to read it. I read it, and out of character, and we finished the show, and John, with the sign-off, John was furious, and he said, "That is the most unprofessional thing I have ever seen in my life. How dare you to do that to another actor? That is most unfair and very unprofessional." And Lucille said, "What?" And he said, "That was your speech." And she said, "It was not," and looked back. And sure enough, she found out that it was her speech. And she said, "Oh, golly, yeah, that's right." And so then I said, "Well, it's not unusual, and I didn't mind, Lucille, because you are always positive and sometimes right." And this is her own description of herself nowadays.
We always say that to each other when we get caught in one of the many mistakes that we make. Carl says it, Lucille says it, and I say it.
Those were great days, though.
They really were.
Had a lot of fun.
They were indeed. And there was a thing that I would like to pick up that we dropped for a moment there. You said it must have been easy coming in once you got the character settled. It was. That was why we could do it so well. But we then had to be aware of the characters who were new, who were not permanent characters, and we had to help them along. And if they were dragging in tempo, we would pick up tempo, and we would support the new people. And that brought about the peculiar thing of what they called a closed shop. There were about 200 actors in New York and in Chicago, I don't know the number, who worked most of the shows. Because in the daytime, having only 1 hour's rehearsal, they couldn't take a chance on someone they didn't know. So that it was felt that it was a prejudice and unfair to anyone who was not one of the few hundred. But it was a an insurance that the producer had to have.
You know, I think the soap operas really could live again on radio today. Because if you think about it, the soaps on television are really radio shows. They move slowly. There's not a lot of action. And people have the women who are home listening have the television on, and they're moving about the house listening to it, maybe occasionally pop in on it. And it would be just as easy to turn on the radio. Wouldn't it be great to hear Lorenzo Jones and Bell?
Sort of doing that. There are some recordings apparently extant. I don't know where they've come from, whether people have sold the shows they took off the air or what it is, but they are playing some of the old shows. I know The Shadow has been on and various other...
Well, a number of the old-time radio shows, yes, are coming back. Now, these are the old shows.
The old ones.
Replaying and having a good surge of interest from people who remember them and great amount of interest from people who didn't get a chance to hear them because they weren't around.
Do the young people like them?
I'm interested in that.
That's very nice. I know that High Brown has he finally persuaded and most successfully a network to take the Mystery Theater that he does, and he's come out here several times and has used all the old.
There is a new series of soap operas for radio that is being made available to certain stations across the country too.
Are they made in Canada?
No, I think they're done in New York. And they're produced, as in the old days, by an advertising agency. And they are in radio and in television today. They do a lot of bartering, which means they provide the show to the station for nothing. And inside the show, there are 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 minutes worth of commercials for a national product, and then other minutes of time available for the local station to sell. And they have this new package of 3 or 4 soap operas, I guess, available in, I was reading not too long ago, in maybe 20 markets across the country. So it's the beginning of something on a 5-day-a-week basis.
I'm glad to hear that because the Farrows, who wrote Lorenzo Jones, said, golly, why can't we do a radio show 5 days a week, and it would be simple to write because we're accustomed to writing for you, and so I went to CBS and spoke to them, and they said we are not doing any syndication at all now, and they suggested that I talk to someone who was doing syndication, and he said that they were not interested in financing anything of that kind.
Well, maybe now is the time to jump in there again and see whether we can persuade them, because it would be so much fun to work with the people that we've known for so many years. And
you know, the interesting thing about it could be done very economically, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you don't have sets to worry about. All you need is you need a good professional sound man.
You certainly do.
Yes.
You know, that's the important thing.
And how marvelous they were, and are, the ones that a few
that are
still working.
The ones that are here now.
They are really such talented people. And we used to have so much fun with the sound man. Some of the funny things that would happen is when a turntable wouldn't work properly or something, and we'd have to fill in the time. There's a story that's terribly funny, but it goes on too long. I'm not going to tell it now. But I look back on those days and realize that the sound man was absolutely essential to us.
And couldn't get you to tell that story.
Well, it's a terribly long story, and I don't think it would be really terribly funny unless you could see me. I have to act it out while I'm being seen to show you what our sound man looked like when this was happening and so forth. But those were things that happened in the studios that we all remember together. That's another thing that's so marvelous about the business. You have common memories.
Because we knew the character so well, we... and did not have a long enough time to rehearse as you do in the theater to really shape a thing for radio. The best thing that you could achieve in radio was a real spontaneity. And so in order to keep from going stale, we would sometimes do the one of the rehearsals with tongue in cheek and do...
Sometimes, you always did.
Well, most of the time, yeah. And there was a thing that happened with the sound man on our Gal Sunday. There was a horse who drew the carriage at Black Swan Hall, and Henry used to go out and in the cart and with Moon the horse, and the sound man and I, with our voices and with various sounds, built up a relationship between Moon and Henry that Moon was really in love with Lord Henry.
Oh, I never knew that.
The horse was in love with Henry, and one day when they were out, the sound man did the whinnies and various things, and I talked back, and Moon decided that she was going to climb up into the cart and sit with Henry. And he did all of this with sound, you know, on the sound table, and Moon trying, and Henry saying, "Down, girl, down." And that was John McCluskey. He was a very good sound man.
Oh, if there's time on the tape, there's one nice thing, not a sound man, but an organist. You know, we have the organ working very hard on all of our soaps, and I should say serials. I know that soaps are frowned on. But anyway, the man on, I think it was Laura Lawton, was our organist, was a young man and a very good, very good man. And I had a kind of a conversation in my mind at the end of one of the shows that went on for about a page, where on echo the person I was imagining I was talking to answered me, and then I answered back with my natural voice. And the person who was supposed to do that part of the conversation forgot that he was supposed to do it and had left the studio. And we came up to this place, and there's nobody on the echo mic to talk back to me in my dramatic conversation with him, fantasized conversation. So I got scared. I saw there was going to be a big blank and didn't know quite what to do. And I started the conversation very tentatively, and Ted, the organist, played the answer on the organ. He used the same rhythm that the man had used in rehearsal, and my ear picked up the fact that he was using the organ to say those words, and the whole thing was just played that way, with the organ saying the other person's part.
Very
now, that was pretty quick thinking, and certainly rescued a show, because I don't know what we would have done without that.
Yeah. Well, an organist would have had the script right along with him, following, watching for cues.
Yes, and he could see what had happened, that I was without a partner in this speech, and he just sort of, I don't think he had time to think about it, he just did it.
Yeah.
And it was remarkable. I was very impressed at that.
Amazing teamwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The organist for Lorenzo Jones is out here, Anne Leaf.
Ah.
And she was one of the great organists, theater organists and radio organists.
You folks are very busy these days, as I know you stopped over here to chat with us on your way to a couple of recording sessions, each independent recording sessions, right?
They're not recording sessions, they're auditions for commercials.
Oh, I didn't want you to tell that, because that means we haven't got the jobs, and we may not get the jobs.
Yeah, but auditioning for a job has been a way of life for both of you folks for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And I suspect, and I know, that you've been very successful at many of those auditions, because you've been a big part of radio and television, and today the voiceovers and
that's one of the things that interests us. And I wonder if you or the audience or somebody will give us a clue. Carl and I both would like to do voiceovers. It's a very specialized field, and we both think that we have a background for it. And peculiarly enough, all of the commercials that we have done since we've been out here have been face commercials. That is,
really?
We are seen on camera.
Very little voiceover.
I think I have only even auditioned for two voiceovers since I've been here, and I've been here since 1957. I think you've probably auditioned for a few more than that, but we don't get them. I don't know whether it's that we don't sound like the person next door or what. I once was told I sound just like Katharine Hepburn. Do you think I do? I don't.
No, I think you sound a lot like Joan Alexander.
Really?
Yes.
Joan Alexander's an old friend. Really?
Yeah, she was... she was, for our listeners, she was Lois Lane for many years on the Superman show.
Yes. Have you been in touch with her?
No, not yet.
I don't think she has been doing any. Maybe she did it. She's done it. She and Joan Banks both have done some of High Brown's shows, I think, in New York.
Yes, in New York. Uh-huh. Here, as you listen to the Mystery Theater, you hear a lot of the great voices.
When we were back there,
Stotts Cotsworth, I think, is on there. And
Dryden. Wonderful actor. Yeah. Bob Dryden. Marvel. He does a lot of them.
Oh, a lot of the people that did High shows. In the old days work. Joan and I each did one when we were back there last year, and they were all people we knew, and the sound man, interestingly enough, was the son of the sound man whom we used to work
really?
With.
Oh, really?
Yes, that was very nice.
Well, what about... maybe we could have an audition right now.
Oh, all right, go ahead.
Suppose we said you're in the radio station, you're in the studio, you drop your scripts, and they're scattered all over the floor. The scene is you, Joan, are about to leave your husband. You have had an argument. You're about to leave your husband. Carl, you're very docile about this. You can't understand why she's going, but
I'm the husband.
You're the husband. The husband. You're the wife. You've just about had it up to this point.
What point have we gotten to in this plan of separation?
That's up to us to decide.
Oh, is it?
Certainly.
Oh.
You're the next year of your career depends on this.
I see.
So all the right. Organ music has just come up with a great stinger or something like that.
Okay. All right, Carl, no more.
What?
I'm leaving the keys. I'm going to leave the house.
What?
You will find me if you want to find me through my mother. You know the telephone number there, and she can reach me. I'm not telling you where I'm going.
You can't leave me and the children like this. This is ridiculous.
I never said I was leaving the children.
Well, you can't take the children.
Are you sure I can't? Where are they now?
They're upstairs in their
room. No, they're not upstairs in their room. I've taken care of all of that, and I don't want any more discussion about it. You're not somebody I want to leave the children with, Carl.
Why? Now, wait a minute. You don't have the right to do anything
about
that.
I don't know anything
kind.
About
Look,
legality.
I can call the police and then have you stopped.
Try it.
All right. Where's the phone?
You see why I can't leave the children with you? This is your own house. You've lived here for 14 years, and you don't...
When you hit me on the head with something like that, no wonder I don't know where the phone is.
Sorry, I'm afraid I broke up and ruined the whole
thing. I'm still terribly sincere about the whole thing. Don't leave me, please.
Oh, that's marvelous. That's great. See?
It's a little hard to fight with Carl.
Lorenzo wouldn't know where the phone was either. Oh, that's great.